to be means to communicate. These are the words of Mikhail Bakhtin. A Russian philosopher and literary critic, Bakhtin looked at literary theory, ethics, and the philosophy of language. A lot of specialists have been informed by his work, including literary critics, film scholars, theologians, political scientists, anthropologists, language and communication scholars, and others. I'll admit, this episode is chock full of Bakhtin's influence on communication. But I just finished my graduate program in communication studies at Ball State University, and I'm feeling inspired. So, we'll start at the beginning. Mikhail Bakhtin was born November 16th, or the 17th. When I'm certain I've deciphered the correct date, it's contested by another reliable source. So here, I'll acknowledge both, but I lean toward the 17th. I invite listeners always to correct and comment on content here. Just visit beautifulgraysponge.com and connect. Now, moving on. Born in the middle of November, 1895, in Orel, also known as Oryol, the southern region of Russia, to a family of five children. He was the third. With three sisters, Ekaterina, Maria, Natalia, and his older brother, Nikolai. The two brothers were close, even if they were quite different in demeanor. Mikhail, the calm and more reserved brother, looked up to Nikolai, the more outgoing and impulsive one. Historically, the family came from nobility, all the way back to the Middle Ages, but their aristocratic origins no longer held any land or title. Despite this, the family wasn't poor. Their parents were liberal-minded and interested in culture. His father was a banker, and his father's father was a banker. But because of the threatening and uncertain Russian upheaval during this time, the family relocated all throughout his childhood. Bakhtin spent parts of his childhood in Orel, Vilnius, and Odessa. This instability did not affect their education, though. He and Nikolai received lessons at home in Greek poetry from a German governess. And after the family moved to Vilnius, Lithuania, when he was nine, he attended schools there in the Russian-ruled city. At the age of 15, he and his family moved to Odessa in Ukraine, where he graduated from the first gymnasium. From there, he went on to study philology, which is the study of literature and language, at the University of Odessa for a year. Another significant aspect of his life was his poor health. During his adolescence, at the age of 16, he began to suffer with osteomyelitis, a chronic disease that causes inflammation and destruction of bone tissue. This would affect him the rest of his life. But, a testament to his mind, he didn't let his poor health affect his intellectual stamina. Besides Greek poetry, he also studied Greek, Hellenistic, and modern European philosophy, including Buber and Kierkegaard. In his adolescent years, along with his brother, he began to develop an interest in radical philosophical ideas, reading the works of German philosophers Nietzsche and Hegel. He and his brother, joined by a group of friends, discussed and debated revolutionary ideas. These early interactions led Mikhail to question and challenge established norms throughout his life. In fact, he once wrote, quote, "Truth is not born, nor is it to be found inside the head of an individual person. It is born between people, collectively searching for truth, in the process of their dialogic interaction." End quote. In 1914, Bakhtin entered the University of St. Petersburg in Russia with Nikolai, and the two brothers shared living quarters. Here, he continued his studies in philosophy and literature. But soon, his entire family became separated by the Russian Civil War and the ensuing social turmoil. When the Russian Revolution broke out in 1917, Nikolai joined the White Army, the military group against the Bolshevik forces. But when the royal forces were defeated, Nikolai left for England and remained in exile the rest of his life. Mikhail, though, remained in Russia and continued his studies until 1918. And after his university experience, Bakhtin taught high school for a brief period in Neville, a small city in the western region of Russia. This is where he and other young intellectuals first started to convene what would become known as the Bakhtin Circle. More on that in just a moment. It was also during this time that in 1921, he formed another important relationship. While suffering with the osteomyelitis, he contracted typhoid and had to be hospitalized. The nurse who tended him was Yelena Alexandrovna Okolovich. Later that same year, she became his wife. During Bakhtin's time, there were a lot of intellectual debates around symbolism, which focused on the relationship of things, and formalism, which focused on forms, obviously, and the concreteness of things. Also during his time, and what informed his writing, were the critical upheavals in Russia following the Civil War there. This, along with his interest and awareness in the philosophy of language and poetics, ignited his intellectual circle of conspirators. The Bakhtin Circle, as it came to be known, focused their work on the significance of social life in general and artistic expression in particular. With an initial interest in the literary realm, they explored the way in which language reveals the conflicts between social groups. The central view of the circle was that linguistic creation is dialogic through the process of social interaction. Think of symbolism and how it's centered on narrative and relationship rather than form, and that this leads to the interaction of different social values being used and reinforced in the language of daily life. The authorship of many writings that came out of this circle continue to be challenged even today. While uncertainties and disputes abound on who wrote what, the controversy of authorship may have been on purpose because the group valued the interdependence of ideas and worked collaboratively. None either denied or demanded recognition. Some sources also say that many writings were assigned to others in order to protect Bakhtin from Stalinist censorship. For example, his books on Freudianism, 1927, Formalism, 1928, and on Marxism and the Philosophy of Language, 1929, they were all published as the works of others, as were a number of important essays. Besides famine, the repressive dictatorship under Stalin cracked down on these unorthodox intellectuals from 1924 to 28. Then, in 1928, Bakhtin, whose health had already begun to deteriorate, was arrested, presumably because of his connection with the St. Petersburg Religious Philosophical Society, and sentenced to 6 years exile in Kazakhstan, where he taught bookkeeping and remained until 1936. With the tightening of censorship at that time, Bakhtin spent most of his adult life in political trouble with the regime, and the suppression of unorthodox intellectuals in the Soviet Union at the end of 1928 ended the Bakhtin Circle. There was so much conflict. Russian populism at this time was opposed to the abstract intellectualism of those revolutionaries who tried to teach the peasants, or to invoke on them the ideals of Western socialism. They also opposed Second International Marxists, who thought capitalism was unavoidable in the development of Russia. After Kazakhstan, he moved to Saransk in 1936 to teach literature at the Mordovian Pedagogical Institute, but he only stayed a year. Due to a political purge, he fled to a micro-district outside of Kimry. Even during all of this fleeing, he wrote extensively. And what's more, his productivity wasn't even hampered when in February of 1938, one of his legs was amputated. He'd been suffering from inflammation of the bone marrow due to the osteomyelitis, which gave him significant pain, high temperatures, and often confined him to bed for weeks on end. Between 1936 and 1938, he completed a book on the Bildungsroman. I learned about this when learning about American novelist Ralph Ellison, a previous Beautiful Gray Sponge feature, by the way, about his epic novel Invisible Man. So Bildungsroman is a literary genre that focuses on the psychological and moral growth of the protagonist, usually from childhood to adulthood, and the character change is important. Bakhtin wrote about the significance of this genre in the history of realism. His manuscript, which was actually approved for publication, was largely destroyed in the early days of the German invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941. Why? Well, the story goes that Bakhtin used it for cigarette papers during the wartime paper shortage. Yep, a heavy smoker. He gradually smoked away all but a fragment of his manuscript in desperation during World War II. After Germany invaded Russia, he was allowed to teach German and Russian at a high school and eventually returned to Saransk, capital city of Mordovia in Russia, as a university professor of Russian and world literature. After World War II, in 1946 and 1949, he defended his controversial dissertation on Rabelais, the Renaissance French writer. But this doctoral thesis was denied because of the hostile ideological climate of the time. In fact, it would not be until 1951 that Bakhtin was eventually granted the qualification of doctoral candidate, and a study on Rabelais would be published in book form in 1965. What was so controversial about it? Well, apparently, even after its translation and publication, it caused commotion among folklorists, anthropologists, and social historians, with its theory of carnival and of ritual inversions of hierarchy. In ultra-simplified terms, and again, if I have it wrong, please write and correct me, Bakhtin concentrates on the collapse of strict hierarchies by looking at how living and working collectively, in accordance with the rhythms of nature, can challenge those power structures of hierarchy. His communication theories on the carnivalesque, as it's called, criticized any dominating perspectives that would silence others. Bakhtin wrote essays on novels as a dialogic genre about the struggle of competing discourses and text. His study of Dostoevsky had actually appeared under his own name in 1929, but only after his arrest and sentenced to exile. Then the book quickly disappeared from sight. Censored or not, this work aroused intense interest among literary theorists about the concept of the polyphonic novel, referring to the many authorial voices that can be inferred in the novel. Bakhtin believed that there was a mutual relation in the novel between meaning and context with the author, the work, and the reader, each constantly affecting and influencing the others, and that all of these were influenced by existing political and social forces. Hence, he developed his theory of polyphony, or dialogics. For example, Bakhtin summarizes Dostoevsky's writings by saying, quote, "It could be said, with certain reservations, of course, that a person of the Middle Ages lived, as it were, two lives. One that was the official life, monolithically serious and gloomy, subjugated to a strict hierarchical order, full of terror, dogmatism, reverence, and piety. The other was the life of the carnival square, free and unrestricted, full of ambivalent laughter, blasphemy, the profanation of everything sacred, full of debasing and obscenities, familiar contact with everyone and everything. Both these lives were legitimate, but separated by strict temporal boundaries." End quote. He introduced the term heteroglossia, meaning a diversity of voices. Styles of discourse or points of view in a literary work, and especially in a novel. To illustrate this, he wrote, quote, "Languages of heteroglossia, like mirrors that face each other, each of which in its own way reflects a little piece, a tiny corner of the world, force us to guess at and grasp behind their inter-reflecting aspects for a world that is broader, more multi-leveled, and multi-horizoned than would be available to one language, one mirror." End quote. Stepping into a bit more influence he's had on communication studies is his dialogic perspective. He argued that speech communication is dialogic, and that the historical context and social influence of an individual's experience plays a significant role in the interaction of speech and in literary reading. Hence, his obsession with the novel. A self is really a co-being in the sense that no one exists as a separate entity. There's always relation to another, a mutual authorship that is ongoing, unfinalizable. Bakhtin referred to a unit of conversation, whether it be a single word or an entire novel, as an utterance. An utterance. Influenced by Bakhtin's theories, Leslie Baxter, a renowned communication scholar today in interpersonal and family studies, explains this concept in her book, Voicing Relationships, as she talks about conversations between people. Quote, "Because talk is conceptualized as an utterance chain, all talk can be viewed as relational communication. That is, any utterance is part of a dialogue in which it responds to prior discursive utterances and addresses anticipated discursive responses of others. The discursive voices of others are with us in our talk. The very concept of an utterance, thus, is relational." End quote. Thinking of the utterance chain, it reminded me of the many iterations of ourselves that we bring to a space. All the versions of ourselves that we have led up to that moment into a space with a unique time and place that Bakhtin would call a chronotope, mixed up with others and all of their collections of self iterations, and on and on and on. The dialogic is focused on the betweenness and the relationship of the interlocutors, the communicators, and less on the actual message. A great example of Bakhtin's dialogical approach can actually be found in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. A comm scholar, Alexandra Castro-Clarin, actually published a paper that studied a sample of letters from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood from the perspective of Mikhail Bakhtin and the conversational moment. A moment that, quote, "provokes an answer, anticipates it, and structures itself in the answer's direction." End quote. Clarin examines the communication ethics at play in the lettered correspondence between Mr. Rogers and his television audience. You see, she differentiates between two models. The previous mass communication method as linear transmission, like senders who merely create the message and send it out, uninterrupted, compared to how Mr. Rogers shifts that model into a transactional one. Communication becomes a process that's not just something we engage in, but an experience that affects and changes us. To Bakhtin's theory, Clarin writes, quote, "The transactional view further suggests that each communicator is at once a sender and receiver, emphasizing the all-encompassing nature of communication as a symbolic production of reality." End quote. Bakhtin's dialogical approach focuses on the transactional rather than transmittal, the transaction versus transmission. Back to Baxter and her relational dialectic theory, RDT, which expands on Bakhtinian dialogics. She explains that the self that is conceived in the dialogic is always under construction through interaction with others who are different from oneself. Communication is not just about transmission, merely carrying information through a reduced, static self. Communication is a transactional, interactional, dialogic struggle where identities are shaped and always indeterminate, fluid, and fleeting. So, from a dialogic perspective, the selves in communication are not performed autonomous entities, but instead are continually constituted in communication. Bakhtin's influence on communication can also be applicable to organizational leaders, Going back to his concept of polyphony, which he addressed in regard to the novel, we can look at this in work life too, or other groups. Some comm scholars, Kevin Barge and Martin Little, wrote about it this way, slightly paraphrased, but I'm going to quote. On one hand, the voices within a harmony may complement one another and produce a tuneful sound. We refer to this as positive polyphony, in which the multiple voices within the conversation are retained, respected, and woven together in such a fashion that they infect each other in a complementary manner. When people come together seeking solutions for problems, or play with alternative ways of framing issues, they're engaging in positive polyphony because the different solutions or frames coexist with one another and may actually serve as the inspiration for additional solutions or frames. They go on to say, on the other hand, the many different voices within a harmony may sometimes clash with one another. Borrowing from Bakhtin, this type of blending is called constructive cacophony. For example, in modern music that emphasizes dissonant chordal structures, right? It may sound as if the notes are actually fighting against and opposing one another, yet this harsh, discordant sound actually makes a significant contribution as it provides scaffolding from which the musical structures of the piece can be resolved. In dialogue or work life, encouraging dissenting and contradictory voices can lead to high-quality decision-making. In addition, creating a conversational pattern where certain voices dissent and oppose the dominant view adds complexity and chaos to a situation, which leads to higher levels of innovation and creativity. End quote. A last word on this segment about his influence on human communication. Writers Katarina Clark and Michael Holquist researched into the life and work of Bakhtin probably most extensively, including first-person accounts. Writing about Bakhtin, they believe that what was most relevant and inherent to his theories in various fields was his lifelong reflection on the relation between self and other. Bakhtin wrote that, quote, "The single adequate form for verbally expressing authentic human life is the open-ended dialogue. Life, by its very nature, is dialogic. To live means to participate in dialogue." End quote. Bakhtin believed consciousness could only exist with another, not in isolation. He said, quote, "I am conscious of myself and become myself only while revealing myself for another, through another, and with the help of another. The most important acts constituting self-consciousness are determined by a relationship toward another consciousness. A person has no internal sovereign territory. He is wholly and always in the boundary, looking inside himself. He looks into the eyes of another or with the eyes of another." End quote. Along with the utterance in conversation, Bakhtin located humanness in this way too. He said, quote, "As long as a person is alive, he lives by the fact that he is not yet finalized, that he has not uttered his ultimate word." End quote. Always challenging the status quo, he lived in a kind of internal exile within Russia. From 1941 to 63, although he continued to write, he remained hidden from the mainstream Russian intellectual community. In fact, it wasn't until 1963 that he was rediscovered by a group of younger scholars led by Vadim Koshnev, intellectuals at the Gordy Institute, who, upon finding out that he was still alive, encouraged him to republish the 1929 Dostoevsky book and come to Moscow. By then, the more liberal atmosphere of the so-called thaw following Khrushchev's ascent to power was less repressive to divergent thinkers. Although his many works were slow to be published in Russia, and slower yet to be translated into English, His writings have since been widely regarded. In his later life, Mikhail was fortunate to witness a renewed interest in his works. In the 1970s, when most of his circle of friends had died, his reputation had extended to France, and then in the 1980s to England and America. With these more recent translations, he's since been acknowledged for his contributions to linguistic, literary, psychoanalytic, and social theory. As obscure as he was for most of his life, his older brother Nikolai, exiled to Western Europe, remains even more obscure. Surprisingly, although Nikolai ended up having more advantages in Western Europe, studying at the Sorbonne and Cambridge, and becoming close friends with Ludwig Wittgenstein, it was Mikhail, working in the difficult circumstances of internal exile, who became the more well-known philosopher. In fact, according to a blogger who did some very in-depth research on Nikolai, check out my sources by visiting beautifulgraysponge.com for that blog entry, he wrote that, quote, "One day in a Parisian bookshop, Nikolai came across a copy of a work by Mikhail on Dostoevsky. He had not heard from him since the early 1920s. During the Second World War, Nikolai learnt of Mikhail's arrest in 1929 and assumed he'd perished during the Stalin's purges of the 1930s. End quote. As Bakhtin's health continued to decline, largely due to emphysema, he was taken to a hospital in Moscow in 1969, and in May 1970, he and his wife, who would die a year later, were moved into a retirement home just outside Moscow. Bakhtin continued to work until just before his death, on March 7th, 1975, in Moscow, then the USSR. Because his relationship with his brother meant so much to him, and because it likely inspired his ideas on dialogic communication, recognizing and valuing the diverse perspectives of others, I thought I would end with something Nikolai wrote. He wrote, "I know that when people talk of death of senseless, they are not speaking of the one who has just died, but of external things, of all that he might have done and attained, that he has left undone and unattained. But at such times as I have felt in myself the power to force my way through the external chance and meaninglessness of events, I have realized that death is not something alien, exterior, and violent. That an end, annihilation coming by chance from without, is only possible for inanimate objects. For the living, it is not simply an end, but always a fulfillment. It does not come to him from outside, but grows within him. All his life it is maturing in him, nourishing and strengthening itself on his joy, his wisdom, his pain, and ascending slowly like the sun from the depths within him." And that is the life and work of Mikhail Bakhtin. I hope the thoughts and reflections you may have had as you listen to this episode become an iteration of yourself that you bring to your next conversation somewhere in place and time, a chronotope, and that you honor every utterance chain you get to experience. Your listenership is a gift. If you'd like to comment, correct, or suggest a feature, please reach out by visiting beautifulgraysponge.com. Let's make this more than transmission. Let's transact. I love what communication can be. I wish more people communicated better, or at least tried. I once heard of a comedian, Dylan Morin, who expressed that, and this is paraphrased, "War is not conflict. War is the inability to have conflict." As I get the privilege to graduate from a U.S. institution while many parts of the world are at war, I see how this is oddly juxtaposed to these significant and critical events, and how so many people and other living things are suffering. I hope more people get curious about why communication is life. Or as Bakhtin said, to be means to communicate. For that, I want to acknowledge you, the listener. I hope you stay curious. and thank you for listening.